accession number 18527, reel 2.
Norman Lithgow, reel 2.
Thank you.
You were just telling me about this work with the models. What happened next?
Well, I think we were on the island until the early part of 1940, and then we moved to East Grinstead, where it was a matter of getting the lorries all waterproofed for the landings in Normandy. And we were then on a 3-hour leave limit. And we were there for a few weeks until a little, it would have been about the end of May, we had a call and it was everybody packed, and we went down to the station early in the morning, and we were driven to, we travelled to Portsmouth in a compound there. In, we knew there was something, or we thought there must have been something going to happen shortly. Anyway, we went into this compound and we were issued with a French phrase book and French money. I don't know quite why. We had the money, but it looked a bit obvious at the time, and we wondered, you know, at the time why that should have been so open. Anyway, we were only there a few days, and one morning, which turned to be D-Day, we saw the planes going across with the gliders, and it was a terrific show in the air, and we thought, well, this is it, you know. Anyway, it was this was early in the morning, about 6 or 7, and we were then told to get our kits packed, and we were then taken down to a LTC, a land tank craft, at Portsmouth, and we went on the boat. This was in the afternoon of D-Day, and from then we went over to the coast of France.
What was the crossing like?
It was rather rough. And I was badly seasick the whole time.
What were you carrying with you personally?
We had our normal kit, and I had Bren Gunn, and my friend, he had the ammunition. And that, and our own kit, you know, it was a, we only had personal kit and normal 3-day ration, I think.
What rank did you hold then?
Lance Corporal.
And did you land on the beach?
Yes, we landed. What happened, we were there all night watching the progress of the boats, and the sky was full of light and shells and flying onions and everything the whole night. It was a terrific bombardment, and we went in the morning. It was early morning, and we were, most of the night we would get a call, kits on, and we would put all our kits on, and right, kits off, we weren't going to do the landing because of some reason or other. Anyway, we eventually did go, made this landing, and we went into the shore and we hit a sandbank, which meant that it was, you know, up to 4 or 5 feet of water to go through. Anyway, one of the sailors swam to the shore with a rope, and we had to kind of get in the water and get across, you know, kind of overhand on the rope to get ashore, while this sailor held the rope or fastened the rope. And we all got off there. It was a little period where it was very deep, you know, it was up to your mouth, the water, and I mean, I was a little taller than my fella. He was bobbing up and down, this Jackie Braithwaite was the fella. And anyway, we did get off, and it wasn't too bad. We did lose one man, company tailor, who unfortunately had his Mae West too low, and he turned upside down, and I think it was in front of us, and I don't think anything could be done for him. He just went.
Just drowned?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, because he had it, I say he had his Mae West low, and of course when he turned over, the weight of his equipment counterbalanced his legs, and that was it. It was unfortunate, but we just heard this after we landed about him, but rather sad, just for the landing.
Which beach did you land on?
Gold Beach.
And this was D-Day itself?
No, D-1, D-plus-1.
Was there any enemy firing at
you? No, no, the beaches were clear. We had to assemble on the beach, and the company all got together, and we then had to march to Port Embeson, which that was our destination. And at this period, the it was still in enemy hands when we landed, but was taken overnight while we were going across to that. But we did stay, we stayed in a field overnight to camp before we were about after about halfway, 12 miles or so. And they, the Royal Marines, took the port, and then of course we were marching through to Port Embeson, and we passed a lot of Germans that were coming across on the same road in the opposite direction, who were going back in the same boats that we had come over with as prisoners. That's the first time I've seen the German soldiers, anyway.
What impression did they make?
I don't know. Really, it was a funny feeling to think they were going to go back to England. And, well, they didn't appear to be particularly upset about it. They were just prisoners, and that was the end.
What happened to you at Port Embeson?
Well, then we had to we had a small tank to install. It was only a small tank because they were going to pump petrol across from a tanker initially to this tank, and then it would be fed onto the small army tank carrier, petrol carriers, for the forward troops, which was working really well. The actual Pluto line wasn't working at that time. It was laid within a few mile of the beach before the war, I believe, and we did have a bit of problem with it because of anchorages that had snagged it, and we did get it onto the beach, and we were getting an installation around the harbour walls, and then of course we had 2 days of very bad weather.
What did the Pluto line look like?
The Pluto line was in actual fact about a 4-inch diameter with copper and lead covering and about a 2-inch internal, well, the capacity would have been taken through this 2-inch pipe, but it was covered by all the copper and lead, and it was had to be reinforced because the water pressure would be would come under during the crossing of in the channel, because it went pretty deep, and the water pressure would have flattened it. But if it hadn't been reinforced so well, but that came across two. Well, I say Carn, it was past Carn, it was too Portland Bethan really, and it was about an 80-mile run that they did. They ran a line straight across from Shanklin to Portland Bethan, and that was going to be the supply for all the troops.
So was Pluto just one pipeline?
That's all ahead of the first. They had the one pipeline, but they had to run another one across. They had trouble with the first one, and they had the other one. And then the idea was that we would go, the pipeline would be extended to Cherbourg, but Cherbourg didn't prove to be so easy to capture, and it took several weeks, which put all the pipeline out of gear. We couldn't extend it to Cherbourg where the American troops were, but we did have it at Portland Bethan.
Can you tell me more about the work that you personally did at Portland Bethan?
Yes, we went just outside once the tank was fitted, and we had all these pipes on the harbour during this bad weather. One of our sergeants, Hopkins, he was actually lashing the pipes down onto the quayside to save them being washed off. It was rather a very hairy period. But after that seemed to get organised, it was taken over by the RASC and the Pioneers, and we went inland to near Bayeux, where we were installing this tank farm. It was going to be four tanks. And then we actually had these pylons, the real pylons that were about 30 foot high. And we had to push these up on, and push the nets up, the camouflage nets, and make a big covering, which we were working under, building the tanks. So we actually built the tanks underneath there, while we were in comparative safety, because it was fortunate the enemy didn't have much aircraft around. The Air Force had probably put them out of commission. There were the odd flights across, but we didn't get any attacks on the petrol installation, which was, well, it was very fortunate, because we had petrol pumping into these tanks. In this one tank we'd finished. And once that had got underway, we moved again, and then we were on the road lines, which were the Victrolic pipes, and we went right through with these pipes on, across. We did many road crossings, and I used to be on the welding. I used to do the welding party, and we used to make these pipes, weld these pipes together so they would go under the ground. We would dig a trench, put the pipes under, and leave an end either side, and then that would be coupled up by the our group, or perhaps another group of engineers.
So what were the main problems that you had doing the work at Portland Bethan?
The main problem was they had damage on the pipeline, and I don't know a lot about that. We weren't on that on the naval side, because the Navy were in charge of the pipeline under the channel. We were concerned with the ship to shore, and the installation on land, which meant that we were putting the pipes through, because there were many miles, I think overall there were probably about 700 miles of pipe went into this, to Germany, which it went through everything. It went through Belgium, didn't go through the lower part of France, but it went through Belgium and to Boulogne and past Boulogne. And later that year, we, after we'd taken Boulogne, we were stationed there. We moved into Boulogne while it was still in enemy hands, or we were just outside. And we were there for a few days, and they had a 1,000 bomber raid on Boulogne just to bomb the Germans out. And that's when we went in, and Boulogne was taken. And we were free to carry on with the pipelines at there. And then we were getting lines. We had 5 or 6 lines that come across from England to Belgium, to Boulogne. And we had built a tank on a hill at Boulogne for the inflowing petrol to fill it, to fill up. And it was then either gravity fed or pump fed to forward positions. That was Boulogne.
Did you have much contact with French civilians?
Not much, no. Very little. We used to go to the farms to see, get eggs and whatever we could scrounge, and, you know, in exchange for chocolate or something. That was okay. And we did meet one or two farmers there, and we could go in and they would receive us very well. Received us very well, and although I didn't drink, a lot of our fellows did drink, and they had plenty of Calvados and stuff, and I think they quite enjoyed the trips to farms.
Was this in Normandy?
Yes, yeah. But we went, when we left, when we left Bayeux, we went through, and we had a couple of stops on the way, and this was during the installation work. And then, of course, we went on to Boulogne for the other installation to connect to the English shore, which was only a matter of 20-odd miles. And that was pretty successful, that. It was successful there because it did supply. We were getting through thousands of gallons of petrol a day, and it was no problem. It did work better there than it had done in Port-en-Basson.
Did you get petrol spillages?
Yes, we had problems. We would have a call, and it was the French people, or the, in one instance, the French people had sabotaged the line. They hadn't sabotaged it, actually. They had undone a coupling to get petrol. They would dig a hole under a coupling and undo the coupling, and it would fill up their buckets or whatever they used. And unfortunately, in one case, the pipe actually came adrift, and of course the pressure dropped on the pumps, and we knew there was a big break somewhere, and that was sorted out. It was a job that had to be done, but we found the place with, you know, just water, petrol pouring down the road.
So they were filching the petrol?
Yes, yeah.
And then after Boulogne?
After Boulogne, we went to Antwerp, Lot Lommel. I remember going to Lot Lommel. This was really for making a move to go back farther into the it was the Market Garden manoeuvre, which was the run-up through to the Reichswald Forest. And we went into the Reichswald Forest from Antwerp. We were at Antwerp for a few weeks, but we couldn't do it. It was very cold. We couldn't do any work because everything was frozen. It was really cold winter.
So you weren't actually doing the pipeline work there?
Not there, no. No, this was on a more southerly base where the other companies would have been doing their work, because we did go to the Reichswald Forest and we did start continuing the pipes there.
Whereabouts in the Reichswald were you?
I don't know. We were near the Rhine. We were quite near the Rhine because I remember borrowing a motorbike from the MTE at one time and went over this bridge. They built a Bailey Bridge across the Rhine. And I went, I remember going across this into this big city or town, and it was so quiet and there wasn't a soul about, and it was very frightening. I actually came back. I was a bit scared, you know. It was really a frightening experience to go into an empty town, you know, that had been recently bombed. And anyway, I came back, and it was only a few weeks after that that I had an accident and I was taken to the hospital.
What accident was that?
Well, I had an accident on a lorry, and the lorry, I went over the back of the lorry and I injured my knee.
Is this in the Reichswald?
Yes, yeah, well, we're in the Reichswald.
So where did you get treatment for that?
I went into hospital in Brussels. And they were going to operate, and they didn't operate there, but I was in there for a few weeks. Then I came back to England in a Dakota, and I went into a hospital in Cambridge.
So did that put you right out of the war for good?
Yes, eventually. It was the end of my... It was the end of my army career, really, because... Although they decided they wouldn't operate on my knee because I had fractured a bone, they wouldn't have an operation then, they sent me to a rehabilitation centre. And I knew it was for Japan, and I thought I wasn't very keen on that. Anyway, I had to go sick, and I spent couple of weeks. I had to go to the MOs, and he would say, well, you would have light duty, and I got excused walking boots and excused carrying a rifle and one or two things. And eventually they gave me a ticket there. I was discharged